Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
But I've always found religion to be fascinating. Ideas such as how people act on their beliefs. Pro-lifers murdering doctors.
Pro-lifers murdering people.
And it's irony on the base level, but I like it. You know what I mean? It's real basic irony, but still, you can get a hoot. It's a hoot. It's a fucking hoot. You're pro-lifing, we'll kill your ass. That's what fundamentalism breeds, though. No irony, you see. They take the word literally, you know. Fundamentalist, yeah. Well, once again, I recommend a healthy dose of psilocybin mushrooms. 3 weeks ago, two of my friends and I went to a ranch in Fredericksburg, Texas, and took what Terrence McKenna calls a heroic dose. 5 dried grams. Let me tell you, our third eye was squeegeed quite cleanly. Wow. And I'm glad they're against the law. Because you know what happened when I took them? I laid in a field of green grass for 4 hours going, my God, I love everything. The heavens parted, God looked down and rained gifts of forgiveness onto my being, healing me on every level, psychically, physically, emotionally. And I realized our true nature is spirit, not body, that we are eternal beings, and God's love is unconditional, and there's nothing we can ever do to change that. It is only our illusion that we are separate from God or that we are alone. In fact, the reality is we are one with God and He loves us. Now, if that isn't a hazard to this country, you see my point. How are we going to keep building nuclear weapons? You know what I mean? What's going to happen to the arms industry when we realize we're all one? It's going to fuck up the economy. The economy that's fake anyway, which would be a real bummer, you know. You can see why the government's cracking down on the idea of experiencing unconditional love. It's interesting. Isn't it interesting that two drugs that are illegal, alcohol and cigarettes, two drugs that do absolutely nothing for you whatsoever, and drugs that grow naturally upon this planet, drugs that open your eyes up to make you realize how you're being fucked every day of your life, those drugs are against the law. Wow. Coincidence? I don't know. I'm sure their motives are pure. But, isn't that great? Mushrooms grow on cow turds. I love that. I think that's why you giggle the first hour. It's growing cow turds! Heaven is in a cow's butt! my God. Lift me up out of this illusion, Lord. Heal my perception that I may know only reality and only you.
Stuff like that.
I took mushrooms and went to Astro World, and I had a really bad time.
You're a moron. They are sacred. Go to nature. Wants to be on the black dragon tripping.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 13. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. I've got a bit of a cold this week, so please excuse the sore throat and coughing and nasally sound that I have today. I have a very good show, and thankfully during the interview I did not have this cold, so you don't have to listen to this throughout the entire recording today. In May 2006, a John Hopkins University study on psilocybin, the active ingredient in psilocybe varieties of mushrooms, was published stating that the religious experience had been proven through the use of the active ingredient in psilocybe varieties of mushrooms. The article by Dr. Roland Griffiths et al. Is titled, "Psilocybin Can Occasion Mystical-Type Experiences Having Substantial and Sustained Personal Meaning and Spiritual Significance." It found that, when administered to volunteers under supportive conditions, psilocybin occasioned experiences similar to spontaneously occurring mystical experiences and which were evaluated by volunteers as having substantial and sustained personal meaning and spiritual significance. In a follow-up study by Griffiths et al., published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology in July 2008, confirmed his first study's findings. It found that, at the 14-month follow-up, 58% and 67% respectively of volunteers had rated the psilocybin occasion experience as being among the five most personally meaningful and among the five most spiritually significant experiences of their lives. 64% indicated that the experience increased well-being for life satisfaction. 58% met criteria for having met a complete mystical experience. Correlation and regression analysis indicated a central role of the mystical experience assessed on the session day in and high ratings of personal meaning and spiritual significance at follow-up. Of the measures of personality, effect, quality of life, and spiritual assessed across the study, only a scale measuring mystical experiences showed a difference from the screening. When administered under supportive conditions, psilocybin occasioned experiences similar to spontaneously occurring mystical experiences that, at 14th-month follow-up, were considered by the volunteers to be among the most personally meaningful and spiritually significant of their lives. Tonight I'm happy to present the author of these studies, Dr. Roland Griffiths from Johns Hopkins University. Donations. Thanks to Kaylee and Martin for their donations this week. I really appreciate it. Donations are what keep the show going. This is not corporate media, and by donating, you really show your support for the show. And without the donations, we would not be able to survive and continue. So please donate whatever you can, whether it's a dollar or $5 or $10 or more. We really appreciate it. If you'd also like to support this show through other means, you can get a copy of one of my books from the website, Astrotheology and Shamanism, my first book that I wrote with Andrew Rutaji. I now have the second color edition available for pre-sale on the website. The first 25 of those will come with a free DVD. I also have two copies left of the first 100 numbered and signed of The Holy Mushroom. So two of you still have a chance to get that if you want one. And, you know, hopefully, like I said before, those will become a collector, being that it's the subject that it's in. I can only hope. That would be nice. I can't guarantee it, but, you know, take a chance. And you'll help Gnostic Media out as well. And on the store page of the website, I've also done a lot of updates and everything up there. I also still have two copies left of the first edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, if anybody wants a copy of that.
I've also moved the She Who Remembers audio archives from the Hemperor.net website over to the Gnostic Media website, if anybody is interested in checking that out. Right now, the link is on the bottom right of the front page. I will be updating that with a better link sometime soon. There is also a bigger link on the links page. But there's about 500 hours worth of audio in there, including some Terrence McKenna and Jonathan Ott and many other interviews. And also on the website, for those of you who have not seen the documentary I did with Andrew Rutaji, The Pharmacratic Inquisition, that is available for free on the website, so feel free to go there and check that out. And if you'd like to purchase a copy of the DVD to help us out, support Gnostic Media, that is also available there. And if anybody would like to add me to on their MySpace page, my MySpace.com page is, or it's MySpace.com/Jan_Irvin. Or you can also sign up or add me as a friend on MySpace.com/Gnostic Media. And this is the first show that's recorded in its entirety with the good microphone that was donated from Dave. So once again, David, I know you're listening. I really appreciate it. And upcoming shows include Stephen Booner. I will be recording him today. That is Monday, and Chris Bennett will be coming up, as well as Ernest Werner. I will be recording on Tuesday, and he is the author of the book The Rod of Jesse. I highly recommend listeners check that out if you haven't already. And I've talked a little bit about his background as a former minister of 50 years in previous podcasts. Still haven't released the John Loftus interview. I've just been busy. I will get to that one of these days. I apologize for the delay on that. Also upcoming will be Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State to discuss his new book, Supernatural is Natural, A Biocultural Approach to Religion, as well as Dr. Dennis McKenna. And I think just about everybody knows who he is. Judith Ann Brown, daughter of the famed Dead Sea Scrolls scholar John Marco Allegro, will be on to discuss the re-release of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And also coming up again will be Professor Carl Ruck to discuss his book, The Hidden World, which is a book that I think is highly underrated. And it's left up on Amazon with a 2-star rating by somebody who's done very little research in this field. And it's quite a shame because it's a fantastic 5-star book. So I'd like to have him on to discuss fairy tales and ancient shamanic themes in that book. If you would like to contact me directly, feel free to contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And the website is the same. And without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Roland Griffiths. Thank you for tuning in. I'm here with Dr. Roland Griffiths. Roland is professor in the departments of psychiatry and neurosciences at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And welcome to the show. I really appreciate you coming on, and I'm sure you've got a lot of interesting things that you can bring to the discussion table here today.
Well, I'm pleased to join you on your show, John.
And could you discuss a little bit about your educational background?
Sure. I'm a PhD psychopharmacologist trained in psychology and pharmacology, and have been at Johns Hopkins for over 35 years now, doing both animal and human basic psychopharmacology research with mood-altering drugs, mostly research funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, so looking at drugs of classic abuse, and looking both in animals and humans, characterizing the comparative pharmacology of various drugs and looking at mechanisms that underlie the dependence processes and toxicity associated with drugs of abuse.
And
How did you get started in this area of research?
Well, let's see. So the psilocybin work is is something that's really come along in the last 10 years or so, and it was a circuitous route, to be sure. I started a meditation practice about almost 15 years ago, and that for me personally opened up a spiritual window and got me asking basic existential and philosophical and religious questions about the nature of mystical experience and personal and transformational change. And in the course of getting into that, it renewed my interest in this whole class of compounds, the entheogens or classical hallucinogens, that have been used sacramentally for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And it seemed like a very interesting opportunity to be able to merge some of my research interest and expertise, that is in human clinical psychopharmacology, with what was emerging as a personal, deep personal interest, and that's the nature of mystical experience and spiritual transformation. So we undertook a study with psilocybin, and this was we initiated that process back in the late 1990s, but there's a long and tedious road that we had to follow before we finally completed the approval process. But we initiated a study partly sponsored by the National Institute on Drug Abuse under a grant that I had through them, partly sponsored through some private sector support provided by a group called the Council on Spiritual Practices out of San Francisco. And we conceptualized the study initially as an opportunity to do some very good comparative pharmacology work, just very carefully characterizing the effects of psilocybin, in this case in hallucinogen-naive volunteers. But because of the interest in the sacramental use, we took this as an opportunity to add a bunch of empirically validated measures that have been developed by people in the psychology of religion for assessing primary mystical experience. That's how we wandered into this area, and it's unfolded in a very interesting way.
So, how did you go from spiritual interest into deciding that the entheogens were really the best way to look at this and study it?
It's entirely an artifact of my training in history. I'm a psychopharmacologist, so I study drugs. And had I been a behavioral psychologist, I might have wanted to study prayer. age-old issue about if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I had expertise and have expertise in administering drugs, running rigorous double-blind studies, and being able to tease out pharmacological from expectancy kinds of effects. And surely the literature, as you well know from the types of work you've done, the literature on the sacramental use of these compounds is very compelling. So the two really came together very, very readily for me. And I think one of the interesting pieces that for me was that I really didn't have any strong need for the study to come out one way or another. I would have been happy if the results of the study had shown that psilocybin, you know, failed to produce classical mystical type experiences, and it wouldn't have entirely surprised me had that been the case. I was just more interested in the process. It was an excuse for reading comparative religions and the literature on psychology of religion, which was intensely interesting to me. And you know, and as with anything, when you're in a field long enough, it's always fun to look for new avenues to investigate, to learn new things. So reading about studying the basic clinical pharmacology of the classical hallucinogens was interesting in its own right, just from a basic pharmacology point of view.
So let's go back to the early stages of this area of research and studying mystical experiences with psychedelic drugs. And could you talk a little bit about the Good Friday experiment?
Yeah, so the Good Friday experiment, of course, is a classic experiment done by Walter Pahnke back in 1962. And he was at Harvard at the time, and he took 20 divinity students and gave half of them access, or gave half of them a high dose of psilocybin, 30 milligrams of psilocybin, which was the same dose that we used in our study, and half of his volunteers received a dose of nicotinic acid, which he was using as an active control substance. The 20 volunteers were accompanied in this Good Friday setting. This was done in the Marsh Chapel in Boston during a Good Friday sermon, and the 20 volunteers were accompanied in the chapel by 20 researchers who were there as their guides or sitters, if you will, and half of the researchers also took psilocybin. So, so it's a very unusual kind of context. Psychopharmacology research, because it's an entirely confounded situation where you have a group of 25 people, half of whom have a high dose of psilocybin. The guides received, the researchers received a slightly lower dose. But there's a complete confounding, of course, of the effects of one subject with another subject. I mean, they're looking at each other and reacting to one another, and so it's very hard to tease apart, how much of the effects are essentially a group effect or a reaction to what people are perceiving, the effect that other people are having and they're not. And so from that standpoint, it's a little bit of a sloppy design. Nonetheless, it's a classic study because most of the volunteers that did receive psilocybin did report experiences that mapped on very nicely to what's been described as the classical mystical experience, and reported persisting changes in attitudes, moods, and behavior that Rick Doblin followed up some 25 years later and found that for those people he could follow up, that many of them continued to ascribe remarkable changes to that experience. So it's a classic study. It's a very interesting study, and it's certainly one that has some experimental limitations to it. And so in designing our study, we, you know, we sought to use a more rigorous approach. We addressed many of the same questions that were addressed in the Good Friday experiment, including different controls that weren't present there, and using measures that are now validated, empirically validated measures. And so we sought to address those same types of questions. Plus, we sought to be able to compare the effects of psilocybin with classical drugs of abuse and mood-altering drugs using validated psychopharmacology scales. So ours was, a newer, better, faster, bigger version of the Good Friday experiment. But in effect, replicated the essential conclusions of the Good Friday experiment in a way that was very compelling to me as a scientist. I could be a little bit more specific about about some of the differences in our study from the original Good Friday study.
Please.
And that was that we evaluated our participants. So in our study, we recruited in volunteers who were hallucinogen naive and were interested in spirituality, and I could talk more about why we did that. But it was but because we were interested in sacramental use, that was one of the reasons we had that kind of bias in there. We also thought that there might be some safety element involved in having people who were spiritually or religiously inclined or had a community with whom to talk about the experience, such that if they had an incredibly disorienting experience, they might find a language and a support group to unpack that. So we assessed our volunteers on an individual basis. So we didn't confound it with group interactions. We used empirically validated measures of spiritual effects. So it turns out that what Pankey did, if I could just go back, at William James at the turn of the century, did some of the most eloquent original descriptive work of the primary mystical experience when he wrote Varieties of Religious Experience. And essentially he took the stories told by the mystics throughout the ages and started categorizing some of the phenomenology of what it was that was described in common to these kinds of experiences. And then in the 1960s, a guy named Stace came along and did a more precise descriptive categorization. Pankey took those descriptive elements and put them into a fairly crude questionnaire, and we can talk about the major factors involved in a mystical experience in just a second. But he put it into a questionnaire, but that questionnaire, in terms of science, falls short in that it really doesn't meet the standards that we expect in psychometrics today. It's not the reliability of the items haven't been determined. It hasn't been factor analyzed, so it falls short. And since that time, there have been several scales developed, and they're now widely used. That have psychometrically analyzed the mystical experience. They're drawing on the same descriptive phenomenology that James and Stace and Pankey drew on, but they're just better instruments, if you will. The nature of our study was that we had a much better, we believe, blinding procedures than Pankey did. We also had an active control. I think we had a much better active control. In our study, we compared psilocybin to methylphenidate or Ritalin, but we did so under conditions that are a little complex to describe. But in effect, volunteers didn't know coming into our study whether they would participate in two or three sessions. The only thing they knew was that on one session they would receive a moderate or high dose of psilocybin, and on other sessions they might receive low doses of psilocybin, or they might receive any number of other compounds, many of which had psychoactive effects that overlap with psilocybin. So they knew that they could get nicotine or dextromethorphan or caffeine or Valium or diphenhydramine, all of which have a wide variety of effects. And then our volunteers were also hallucinogen naive, so they weren't able to identify with certainty what they got when they got it. And so that led to this, and I guess I should also add that our guides had the same instructional set. So the Pankey study, half the guides, as I mentioned, actually received psilocybin, which in and of itself is highly unusual. But our guides were blinded with the same instructional set that our volunteers were. So it led to this confusional element that I think protects the conclusions of our study in a way that can't be protected if people know for certain that they're receiving psilocybin versus a control compound. And the other final feature of our study that was different than the Pankey study was that we also interviewed community volunteers, friends, family members, colleagues of our volunteers to get an external opinion about how the volunteers were faring. So the claims that volunteers made after having these experiences of these remarkable changes in attitudes and behavior and emotion, these kinds of claims, we in effect validated by interviewing spouses and family members and friends. So I think it turns out to be a tighter study than the Good Friday experiment, but at its heart, it's a very powerful and, for me, convincing replication that under conditions in which these compounds are taken sacramentally and people are well prepared, we get a high rate of volunteers reporting experiences that map on to the classical mystical experience, and for which they report long-lasting and meaningful changes in their behavior and attitudes, and toward a more pro-social, positive kind of disposition.
What were some of the qualifications and disqualifications for members to be in your study?
Yeah. So we advertised for people who were interested in participating in a study involving the use of psilocybin, a drug that's been used sacramentally for centuries. We required that people have a college education, that they have some interest or affiliation with religious or spiritual community, and so we avoided the atheists and agnostics, and we required them to be healthy, both physically and psychiatrically. In particular, we ruled out anyone with a history of psychotic disorder or bipolar illness, or even a family history of those kinds of disorders, because we were concerned about the potential of these compounds precipitating enduring psychiatric illness. And you know, whether or not they do is a little bit unclear, but from a safety standpoint, we absolutely have to guard against that as a possibility. Other than that, people were just generally high functioning and psychiatrically healthy. So we ended up with a group of volunteers that I think on average were about 40 years of age. They were high functioning professionals generally. We had physicians, psychologists, nurses, social workers, business people, ministers, pastoral counselors, those sorts of folks. And their interest was they were not paid to participate because that wasn't the purpose. Their motivation really was curiosity about effects of psilocybin and this opportunity for deep self-reflection in the context of a study in which they would work pretty intensively with a clinical psychologist prior to the psilocybin sessions. So we had at least 8 hours of preparation time before our sessions in which the volunteers' life history was really reviewed. And the point there being to develop a very close rapport so that the guide or the monitors, and we had two present during the sessions, could provide a container, if you will, a psychological, physical container, such that the individual would feel safe. So people entered into the study curiosity, but they were all hallucinogen naive. So it was a very interesting group of people to work with.
Well, you mentioned that you screened out the atheists and agnostics. Wouldn't that make an even more impressive study if you could show atheists and agnostics having mystical experiences as opposed to people who might already suppose they exist?
Yeah. So that's a great point, and it's a study we would love to do. And so, like I mentioned earlier, so we decided that we'd go with people who had spiritual leanings because of this historical use of these compounds, because we thought there was an element of safety involved, and because it also gave them perhaps a vocabulary in which they might be able to describe these kinds of effects. But your point is very well taken. What happens if people who are not so inclined take these compounds under similar kinds of conditions? And I think that's a very interesting, and it's actually a fundamentally important question.
Well, I think that Dr. Stan Grof has actually shown that people in his lab that were atheists had had full-blown mystical experiences, and that he thought that was rather striking. And I certainly, in my own life in this field of research, have come across many people who said, you know, that they were atheists until they tried psilocybin or ayahuasca. And I've met others who say that they were also Christian or some other religion until they tried these things, and that actually it gave them a much broader perspective of all religions and less adherence to a single dogma type situation.
Yeah. So we've not worked with atheists, I certainly could imagine someone being so attached to an atheistic set of beliefs that they that no matter what the experience was, they might not let go of that. But I could also imagine people making, you know, fundamental changes. Actually, I have I pulled out a quote here that you might, in particular, because of your work in Christianity, find interesting. This is a written comment from a volunteer reflecting on a psilocybin experience. I'll just read it. It says, I felt as if I were being granted a completely new insight into the old adage about love that conquers all. And strange to say, for I'm only nominally a Christian, in the midst of these reflections, I had a vision of Jesus, both of his face, a kind, gentle, beaming face of love, and his crucifixion, now understandable as a kind of emblem of nearly everything I had realized over the past hours, the return to the light and love in the midst of darkness and death, the inner essence of love that transcends all obstacles by its sheer longing, love that's purified by loss and death, and of forgiveness as the inner meaning of this picture of the cosmic destiny of love. So that's a pretty remarkable statement, and it's typical of the it's emblematic of the types of experiences people have. So in this case, someone who's nominally Christian has a very powerful sense of, you know, Jesus and some of the strongest symbols within that tradition. And other people had experiences that, you know, were reflective of other religious traditions.
Interestingly, just on October 28th, Professor John Rush here in California just published his new book called Failed God that actually argues, along with John Allegro, that Jesus was the mushroom. So that would be an even more interesting symbolic area of study as well. More controversial, I'm sure, for many, but interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, indeed.
Let's see. So in your study, most of the people were either given psilocybin, or was each person given psilocybin once, or were some of them given it twice?
Let's see. So in our study, people had two or three day-long sessions, and these sessions were 8 hours in duration. And people received either a high dose of, they received both, a high dose of methylphenidate or Ritalin, which was our control substance, and a high dose on another session, a high dose of psilocybin, 30 milligrams per 70 kilograms of body weight. So that, functionally, that's similar to the Pankey dose, probably a little bit higher given the body weights most people weigh more than 70 kilograms. And then some volunteers had three sessions on which they received methylphenidate on the first two sessions and psilocybin on the third session. That third session, people were unblinded to. So the volunteers who received psilocybin on the final session knew that they were going to get psilocybin, and that was 6 out of the 36 volunteers. Those were the only unblinded sessions in the study, and that condition was added partly as a control condition, so again to add a confusional element to both the volunteers and the guides to essentially make it so no one knew for sure what was coming up next. So everyone got methylphenidate, everyone got a high dose of psilocybin. And
when you say high dose,
the majority.
Go ahead.
So 30 milligrams per 70 kilogram is the equivalent of about 5 grams of completely dried mushroom. So a gram of dried mushrooms, average strength, and I should say that mushrooms vary considerably with respect to the concentration or the dose they deliver. They can actually vary over a tenfold range. So very often, if someone takes mushrooms, they really don't know what kind of dose they're receiving. But on average, with cubensis, we would calculate about 6 milligrams per gram of dried mushroom, completely dried mushroom. So if there's any water weight, then you'd have to have considerably more mushroom.
So
does that answer the question about dose?
Very much. Yeah.
It's I think by many that's considered a relatively high dose of psilocybin, of mushroom.
Relatively. I've had a few experiences with mushrooms, and I would say that I've certainly exceeded that, but that seems to be a good average dose if you're looking for a more spiritual or metaphysical experience as opposed to just doing it in a party type situation, which I don't think is very responsible.
Right. Well, let me make a comment about the situation under which we administered the situation in which the sessions were conducted. So people received this 8 hours of preparation with a clinical psychologist. They came into the sessions interested in self-exploration and also, to the extent that we could encourage it, with sacramental intent. The sessions were conducted in a fairly attractive, aesthetic, living room-like environment with a lovely big couch and overstuffed chairs and oriental carpets and wall hangings and a good stereo system. And people, the volunteer lay down on the couch. We made it up into a bed with sheets and a pillow. They lay down on the couch and put on eye shades to block out all visual stimulation, and then used headphones through which they listened to a pre-recorded program of classical music. And they were asked to direct their attention inward. So this was a completely inward-turned experience, and they started this sometime after taking the capsules that contained psilocybin or methylphenidate, and then were really encouraged to stay with their inner experience. There were two guides or monitors who were present throughout the session, really at the side of the volunteer. And their role was really to provide the safety net, if you will. They would check in occasionally with the volunteer. They would not encourage conversation, but they were there to help encourage the volunteer to refocus and go back in. And if the volunteer came across times of difficulty, which many volunteers did, then the guide or monitor was there to provide reassuring touch or reassuring comment and help ground the volunteers so that they could go back into the experience.
Could you discuss the process of getting your study approved and what you had to go through?
Yeah. So, as you know, these compounds, the serotonergically mediated hallucinogens, have really just been pulled out of human research for, you know, almost a 40-year period.
I'll have to tell you that the word hallucinogen makes me cringe, but go ahead.
There's no good and right word to use we can discuss different alternatives, and I can certainly understand anyone's reluctance to use the word hallucinogen, but likewise I see limitations to psychotomimetic and to entheogen and to all the other variations that we have. So as a pharmacologist, we talk about the classical hallucinogens and being those compounds that produce these interesting changes in perceptual set and mood and cognition that are serotonergically mediated. But if you have a better single descriptive term that would pass muster with pharmacologists, I'm happy to use it.
Well, what do you feel about Stan Grof's opinion that they're not hallucinations at all, but suppressed aspects of human consciousness?
Yeah. So let's see. So that's the problem with hallucinogen is the name. They don't produce hallucinations. Funnily enough, they. It's kind of a pseudo hallucination. There's synesthesias and various perceptual changes, remarkable changes in cognition and perceptual set, but not frank hallucinations in the sense that people feel that there's a reality taking place they've lost some real component of reality testing, and so to that extent it doesn't quite fit. I think there are many different ways of understanding what it is these compounds are doing, whether they're, you can try psychodynamic theories, that talk about it as, ego death and going into spiritual ground being. There are spiritual theories, that might pull, from different realms. As a scientist, I just don't have any data about that, and so I'm quietly attentive to all possibilities, but I'm unlikely to subscribe to anything that I can't empirically try to measure or validate. So I think these are all really interesting descriptive ways of trying to understand these kinds of effects. And, ultimately the meaning is unclear at this point, but, it's very provocative to wonder about it, but I don't hold a strong and fast opinion.
And I noticed from your studies that you don't like to use the word psychedelic because of the negative 60s overtones. And, mind manifesting or mind opening is it kind of, whether it's religious or some psychodynamic sort of feature pulling forth suppressed thoughts, that does really seem to accurately portray it, even though the proper word psychedelic should be psychodelic. I think it was Humphrey Osmond that coined that term originally.
It's a very interesting term, but it does have such cultural baggage attached to it that I'm not sure that I feel comfortable using it because of all the schema that it elicits.
But you're not.
To get back to your.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you don't feel the word hallucinogen might actually have some of those same overtones?
Well, you know, I'm a neuroscientist and come from a pharmacology background, you know, so within pharmacology, you know, we understand the definition of serotonergically mediated hallucinogen, and it doesn't cause any problem. But your point's taken. I mean, a hallucinogen sounds pretty scary too, doesn't it? It's kind of arbitrary my selection of terminology, but I do think that psychedelic is so embedded in the cultural trauma that we experienced and the reaction, the incredible reaction we had against these compounds. So it really gets back to your question about, you know, what hoops did we have to jump through to get approval? And that was in reaction to this, you know, incredible, set of circumstances that unfolded in the 1960s, where the use of these compounds somehow came together with a disenfranchised generation and the anti-war movement and a anti-establishment movement, and we had a huge cultural reaction against use of these compounds that really demonized any legitimate approach to research and science, and took these compounds off of the scientific clinical, desktop for decades. And if you just think about it, it's really remarkable, because just think of what progress we've made in science generally over the last 40 years. I mean, it's we didn't have the computer 40 years ago. I don't even know if we had photocopiers 40 years ago. And pharmacology and neuroscience has moved just as rapidly. I mean, we have such a much more sophisticated understanding of, you know, the nature of neurophysiology and a somewhat better understanding of the nature of conscious and perceptual process. Yet here's this whole class of compounds that clearly produce very unique effects, and somehow we decided as a world culture, gee, these are too dangerous to ever give to people. You know, let's not do that. And somehow it came to be that there's this, complete social conspiracy, with political forces, governmental forces, academic forces. It was almost a consensus that we just can't study these. And so their funding was withdrawn. The regulation requirements went way up. The Drug Enforcement Administration made it very difficult to do this. Academic centers, ran the other way. You wouldn't become a psychopharmacologist and then propose to do research with these compounds without running risk of completely discrediting yourself.
Well,
it's really quite fascinating as a cultural phenomena that this occurred.
Well, I think it's rather fascinating as well that the very person who caused this negative stigma in the entire field, Dr. Leary, Timothy Leary, was also the one who said that, or who is believed to have coined the quote that LSD has the ability to cause psychosis in people who have never taken it. And that it very well describes the exact social scene and political hysteria that we've been dealing with ever since, Leary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a very complex political process, and surely, you know, pieces of that are true, but he also did his part to really undermine and discredit a scientific approach to studying these kinds of compounds.
That's what I mean.
That came together with the
That's actually what I mean, is he's sort of the one that caused all of the negative backlash and everything, and he's the one that, you know, also coined the term. So that's sort of what I was getting at.
Yeah. Well, he had some, he had some incredibly important insights, and he was an advisor to Walter Pahnke on his thesis, among other things. But he also did such damage.
Well, let me ask you this: is there any difference or that you're aware of between the chemically extracted or the synthesized psilocybin versus the active mushrooms?
Mm-hmm. So in our study, we use the synthesized psilocybin as the active drug, so we knew exactly how much we gave. So the psilocybin mushroom, of course, is going to contain psilocybin, but it also contains several other psychoactive tryptamines, compounds that are structurally and pharmacologically related to psilocybin.
Such as?
And we don't know, like baocysteine, for instance, and psilocin, which psilocybin is transformed into, and there's norbaocysteine. And the concentrations of those other compounds, particularly baocysteine and norbaocysteine, can vary across different species of mushrooms, and there's a theoretical possibility that they could interact with one another. But, you know, having said, and then there may be other uncharacterized things within mushrooms that we don't know how they interact with those systems. But as best as we understand the pharmacology of the, you know, the principal agents of mushrooms, you know, our best guess would be that the effects are largely determined by psilocybin, but it actually remains an open question and one that we would love to study and do a head-to-head comparison of mushrooms delivering the equivalent dose of psilocybin as administered in capsules to see whether, in fact, there are any phenomenological or physiological differences between the two.
I would be extremely interested in finding that out myself, or even experiencing the difference between the two. You did a follow-up study a few months back on your original spirituality or mysticism study on mushrooms, and what did you find on the follow-up of that?
Yeah, so we've actually done a couple of other studies. One is we followed the original group of 36 volunteers out to 14 to 16 month follow-up, and you know, essentially showed that these effects are sustained, that people continue to have a very clear and focused memory of the experience. It continues to be described as having all the features of the primary mystical experience. People continue to make these attributions of positive changes in attitude and behavior and pro-social behavior to the experience. So as was the case in the Good Friday experiment, these kinds of effects are simply sustained in memory. People aren't about to forget them. And it really is, I think, the piece of it that makes it so interesting to me as a psychopharmacologist, I've run hundreds of clinical trials with all kinds of different psychoactive drugs. And so I'm very accustomed to assessing the phenomenology and subjective effects and quizzing people about those kinds of effects. And I would have to say that unlike most any other set of compounds I've ever studied, this experience is unique in that the very nature of the experience is one that informs, or people feel that there's a noetic quality to it, a sense of understanding that informs their life going forward in a very profound and meaningful way. So, you know, if you give a high dose of a barbiturate or alcohol, for that matter, or diphenhydramine to someone and ask them about it the next day, they'll sit down and they'll describe the experience to you, but it's retrospective. They're drawing on memory and it tells them something about, you know, what, you know, they got drunk last night and they had a good time or they didn't, you know, but it's something in the past. In contrast, the experience of the primary mystical experience is one in which people have this profound sense that usually includes a sense of unity, the blending of all things, a sacredness, a positivity, a sense of love, and this noetic quality of the experience itself is more real than everyday waking consciousness. And it's that element that I think that people use to inform life going forward. So it's not unusual to talk to a volunteer 2 months or 14 months after an experience and I might say, well, you know, do you remember the experience? And someone might very well say, remember it. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about it. I mean, because it's still present. It's still something that's informing how they comport themselves in life, and it's deeply meaningful to them.
Very interesting. So what historical role do you feel that mushrooms have and other entheogens have in the foundation in the formation of religion?
Yeah, it's interesting to speculate, and I know this is a particular interest of yours, Jan, and it's something that I just can't speak to authoritatively. What I guess I can say is that it seems clear to me that we have these drugs like psilocybin that can occasion these mystical experiences that map on very nicely to classically occurring mystical experiences. And so it looks to me that it's a biologically normal kind of phenomena, and we certainly know that these kinds of experiences can occur in absence of the use of these agents, because many religious and spiritual traditions have developed very good technologies to increase the probability of such experiences through meditation or prayer or fasting or other kinds of austerities. So it seems to me that it's biologically normal, and it's really interesting. And I guess I would subscribe. Or I'd lean toward being a perennialist in so far as best I can see it, these kinds of experience seem to undergird all of the world's religious, the ethical and moral traditions and codes. There's really a sense of commonality to that. So there's some kind of commonality, but now what role specifically entheogens or psilocybin plays in the history of religion, I'll leave that up to you.
Do you feel that there is, from the research, does it look like there's any difference between an entheogen or drug-induced religious experience versus non-drug-induced?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I think I'm struck with the similarities that at least what's been described phenomenologically about the classical mystical experience just maps on incredibly well to what we can occasion with entheogens. But it surely wouldn't surprise me if there are also, elements of differences. And certainly in terms of just probability and intensity, we know that that's really what we have in our experimental model here. We have a situation in which, with high probability, some 70% of our volunteers have a primary mystical experience. And the base rates of these kinds of experiences, even in people who intend them and go into a sacramental, or some kind of sacred experience, would be much lower than that. So we know that the probability is different, but I'm struck with the similarities to what's been classically described, and it really is striking to me that. William James and Walter Stace came out with this descriptive phenomenology of these experiences, based, not on entheogen use, but on descriptions from mystics. The other scales that have been developed since then, there's the Hood Mysticism Scale, there's something called the Piedmont Transcendence Scale, which are also based on some of that same phenomenology. Those scales have been developed, very well validated, and then they show cross-cultural generality. So those scales have been given to people in Iran, who are Muslims. They've been given to people in South America. They've been given to people all over the world in the to use the psychometric terminology, the factor structure of the scale coheres across those different religious traditions. So those scales had never been used with entheogens to assess entheogen action. And in our study, they came out loud and clear, showing this huge effect. So there really seems to me to be some generality to the effect that certainly goes beyond the entheogens.
I would seem to agree with you on that. Let me ask you something about your own study. I know in a lot of the earlier research, the nurses and people involved in the studies were required to have their own prior experience with these substances. Is that the case with your own study?
No, it's not. It turns out that our lead clinical psychologist is Bill Richards, who worked with these compounds and actually was exposed to these compounds in research contexts back in the 1960s, starting with work he did in Germany. So he has a deep understanding of these compounds, both personally and professionally, because then he also worked with Walter Pahnke and Stan Groff at Maryland Psychiatric Research Center and did studies with psychiatric patients and with cancer patients. So he has a close sensitivity to this, and he was responsible for not only monitoring all of our volunteers in our first study, but also training our subsequent guides and monitors. We require that they have significant experiences with altered states of consciousness. You know, but I think there are legal and ethical reasons that we would not want to say that everyone had to have an experience with an entheogen. Although I think some people would certainly argue that experiences of that sort are going to facilitate the kind of experience. I think it's very important from the volunteer's point of view that they are reassured that whomever is their guide or sitter is sensitive to the nature of the effects and how wildly disorienting and uncomfortable and profound these kinds of experiences can be. So it's something that we're quite sensitive to.
Well, you mentioned that you have studied the reactive qualities of many drugs of abuse, and I wanted to talk to you about what you think are the dangers of psilocybin mushrooms and psilocybin in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, first and foremost, these drugs can cause acute fear and panic reactions. And one of the sobering results from our study was that over 30% of our volunteers, in spite of this substantial preparation, our careful selection, and the attentive context in which they took the psilocybin, in spite of that, over 30% had experiences of extreme fear or feeling trapped or anxious. So it's a cautionary note, because we don't know how to protect against that, and we don't really know why some people have those experiences and others don't. I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, potential psychodynamic explanations of, you know, why someone would be more prone to that or not. But one thing for certain is you can't guard against, or you can't guarantee that that's not going to occur. And that being said, that to me represents one of the biggest risk factors, because it's clear that under conditions in which the environment isn't as supportive and the context isn't isn't going to be as helpful, that people can engage in dangerous behaviors. And you know, we do know that that at low probability, but it does occur, that people engage in self-destructive and suicidal types of behavior, panic reactions that just put them into harm's way. So that's first and foremost. And then we screened out people with that appeared to have any sensitivity towards psychotic disorder, including just even family histories of psychotic disorder or bipolar disorder. And the concern there is, can these compounds precipitate enduring psychiatric illness? And the answer there is, we don't know. You know, the cases that have been described in the literature are few and far between, but there are cases, and it certainly is plausible that these kinds of compounds could exacerbate those kinds of brain processes. And so the concern that we would worry about is that someone who was vulnerable toward schizophrenia, you know, might get pushed over the edge on that, and that's a disorder that no one wants to have. And then the final risk of these compounds is the so-called flashback or persisting perceptual phenomena. And this seems to occur at very low rates, and as best we can tell, mostly in people who have used hallucinogens extensively. And for the most part, people will report disruption of perceptual effects. For instance, instead of clear edges on a door sill, there it might be wavy, for instance, or colors might seem brighter. A number of people have such effects, and they're bemused by them. But there are some people who have such perceptual effects and find them disrupting. So we know that occurs, and it appears to be associated with use, but likely pretty excessive use.
What do you feel?
Those are the big risk factors.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I don't know what you consider heavy or extensive use, but I used to believe a lot more in the experience of flashbacks. And as I've progressed in my research and gotten older, I've kind of really taken a second look at flashbacks. And it seems to me that, you know, and I know this, it gets crosses over into metaphysical areas, but it seems to me that, you know, with quantum physics and string theory and things like that, that possibly it's like a radio signal that we're tuning in other areas of perception. And I also wanted to ask you what you feel about Dr. Groff's opinion that flashbacks are specifically related to the inconclusion of the full-blown or the transcendental experience.
So, you know, I think he's probably talking about a little phenomena that's a little bit different than the persisting perceptual effects. So what I was describing with the persisting perceptual effects are, are alterations in mostly vision, that tend to be annoying and not normal. And I think that does occur, and Matt Baggett at University of California has done some interesting survey work, and I think is continuing to do some work in that area. So I think that part is real. In terms of whether there are unresolved issues that come up, you know, that's moving into the psychodynamic kinds of interpretations. I think it's a really interesting framework to consider. But Stan Groff has much more experience in that domain than I do. I wouldn't hold a strong opinion one way or another.
Understood. What numbers of deaths, or do you have any idea, have occurred since, since 1955 with the Western so-called discovery of mushrooms? And today, would you have any idea of the number of deaths directly related to medical reactions to mushrooms, such as stroke or heart attack or something like that, and versus accidents?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. No, I don't have any data on that. We know from the Dawn database, that's the system that tracks emergency room mentions, that toxicity associated with mushrooms is incredibly low. I think it's 0.1% of all mentions. So that would put it in, at a very low number. But we do, you know, we do know, and there are documented cases of people engaging in self-destructive and, you know, behavior to their own demise. So we know that there are those kinds of cases. That those have been well documented. They certainly occur at low frequency.
Would you say that those instances seem to center around our own society's lack of knowledge of proper use of these things, as well as improper set and setting?
Well, yeah, I think it's improper set and setting. I mean, I think what our studies have shown is that it is possible to administer these compounds to a carefully selected and screened group of people. It is possible to administer these compounds safely, so we can build in some of the protections, at least for some of the people, you know, that allow this kind of exploration to move forward, you know, ethically. I think there are real risks associated with the use of these compounds, and you know, your point's also taken that part of the drug policies that we proceed increase the likelihood that they're going to be taken under circumstances that are actually going to be completely contrary to how they would best be taken. But I think that's as far as I can go with that.
Understood. With your background in studying the abuse of drugs, could you compare the dangers of mushrooms to, say, alcohol and marijuana?
Well, let's see. So in terms of abuse, you know, we have different ways of measuring whether or not a drug is going to lead to dependence. That is, whether people, or for that matter, animals, are going to take the drug repeatedly, and it leads to a pattern of chronic self-administration and physical dependence and withdrawal. And on that score, the classical hallucinogens come up looking very safe. It's very difficult to, we have very good animal models for showing what drugs are going to be self-administered, that is, addicting. And we can't get animals to take hallucinogens for the most part. And if you look at the naturalistic patterning of hallucinogen use by even people who advocate their use, it's not a pattern of chronic use, because tolerance develops very quickly to it. Physical dependence does not occur. So even the National Institute on Drug Abuse doesn't consider the classical hallucinogens to be major drugs of abuse or dependence in the sense that they're not addicting. However, the use of these compounds is associated, or can be associated, with these toxic syndromes, be it, you know, panic or concern about precipitation of enduring illness, or these perceptual effects. And it's that level of toxicity that then, you know, brings us into the domain of the Drug Enforcement Administration, because they will schedule compounds that, even if they don't have high addiction potential, they're considered to, you know, have social or physiological toxicity, and it's in that perceptual set that they're considered to be toxic compounds, and that they fall under regulatory control. May not be a very good reason, but that's the way it works.
You mentioned social toxicity. That's a new description to me. Would you discuss that for a second?
I don't think that's where I should go. I mean, I'm not. there's a, you know, all kinds of arguments can be made about the, you know, the nature of our drug law and the nature of drug policy, and it's and that's beyond my job description.
So with the religious experiences that you studied in people, do you think that it's real or just some chemical reaction in the brain? I mean, you know, a lot of the research shows instances of telepathy and things like that, that that many researchers have found inexplicable. Have you come across some of those own experiences yourself that you would possibly consider these things as beyond hallucination?
Let's see. So, I mean, it's a really interesting question, and one, you know, for which we don't ultimately don't have any data. And that's, you know, what's the truth value of these kinds of perceptions, you know, are people merely having a chemical experience, or are they perceiving something that that has more profound spiritual meaning and many wider implications? And you know, and ultimately, we just don't know the answer to that, and we can't know. And the procedures we have for measuring such effects right now are just not up to the task. So there are some people who kind of will argue, oh, you've given psilocybin and you produce this mystical experience that's just God in a pill. Therefore, you know, God is just a serotonergic chemical. And you know, and that makes no sense at all. That doesn't follow logically. It's quite possible that these kinds of compounds are producing changes in the brain. And then what are those changes in the brain? And you know, what's the consequence of that? Is it opening people up to a spiritual experience, an experience of ground being or God or whatever? And we just don't know. That's the, you know, that's the core metaphysical question that's at the heart of all this, and that's really so intriguing. It has to do with the meaning of life, doesn't it?
I would certainly agree with that beyond doubt. Have you made any plans for studying or doing research with these things on mental disorders?
Well, we do have a study that we've initiated in cancer patients who are anxious or depressed secondary to their cancer diagnosis. And so this is clearly a straightforward medically related target, and one of which we're really quite excited about but are very frustrated by the fact that we have been unable to find volunteers to volunteer for the study. So let me tell you just a little bit about it. It's a study that's open to people 21 to 70 years old who have a cancer diagnosis that's potentially life-threatening, and for people who are experiencing some anxiety or depression secondary to their diagnosis. That is, they must think at some level that their disease has made their life worse. And they don't have to have terminal cancer illness. They can and they don't have to necessarily even have recurrence, as long as they have held the diagnosis for more than a year. And we're very eager to screen and enroll people. The study involves 2 day-long psilocybin sessions plus some screening and some follow-up work. And we have a website. It's www.cancer-insight.com. www.cancer-insight.org. Let me just repeat that, www.cancer-insight.org. And that website describes the study, all the qualifications. It provides some video of volunteers in a very similar study that was conducted by Charlie Grobe at UCLA. And so if someone was interested, they could take a look at that, and there's both email and telephone number to get a hold of our recruiter. So we'd be very eager to have any of your listening audience that either knows of someone with cancer, or knows of someone who might know of someone. Perhaps they know of an oncologist or a psychiatric social worker or someone doing alternative care medicine who deals with people with cancer. But we'd love to get the word out about this protocol to a sympathetic audience. It's not a requirement that people be hallucinogen naive. People can have past experience. But I would say that if people had extensive sacramental experience with these compounds, then they're probably not a good candidate for the research, because we really don't have much more than that to offer them.
Understood. So why cancer anxiety? What do you expect to find in that?
Well, so, you know, one of the outcomes of the profound primary mystical experience is, you know, really connecting with these basic noetic insights. And as my colleague, Bill Richards, has summarized them, these noetic insights include the basic reality of God, the indestructibility of consciousness, the interrelationship of all people and things, and the absoluteness of truth, beauty, and love. And the sense really is that someone who's struggling in existential crisis, contemplating their own demise, should they have an experience of this sort, it may go a long ways toward comforting them and toward making peace within themselves and with other people, and increase the quality of the life that we all have. It's just remaining. We're all terminal, after all. And so the thought really is that a disease that's a very serious disease that raises these kinds of existential questions is a good one for as a therapeutic target. There are many other kinds of psychiatric conditions and disorders that might be considered. The other one that we're interested in but have yet to initiate a study on has to do with drug and alcohol dependence, and there the hallmark of the 12-step programs that have been so effective for treatment of alcoholism, really about half of the 12 steps involve acknowledging or surrendering to higher power. And at the core, the basic mystical experience is that.
Well, if I recall, wasn't the founder of the 12-step program part of the original LSD studies?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Bill Wilson, who founded AA and did so on the basis of a primary mystical experience that was occasioned when he was undergoing the DTs, or detoxing from alcohol, had occasion to be exposed to LSD and some of the earlier research, and was very curious about the possibility that it might be therapeutically useful for the alcoholic community. But at the time that he came to that insight, AA as an organization had already organized and organized around a principle that really was not open to exploration of that kind. So Bill Wilson's interest in the hallucinogens really got dropped.
What about studies into, say, creativeness and cognizance? Have there been, are there any plans to do studies in those areas?
Yeah, that I can't speak authoritatively to that. There were some interesting studies of that type done in the 60s. More recently, there's been some follow-up work. There's actually just a recent review that was written in Journal of Psychopharmacology on creativity and hallucinogens. And so that well might be worth pursuing, but it's not an area that I'm expert in.
Would you care to discuss the structure of your new cancer study and say, how many times you expect people to be given doses, or is that something that you don't want out?
No, I'd be happy to just say again, it's simply two sessions, and it's two 8-hour sessions, day-long sessions. People will, after a day and a half of screening, receive at least 4 to 8 contact hours with a clinical psychologist before the first session. And then the sessions are going to be conducted as they were in our original study in this aesthetic living room-like environment in the presence of two guides, and their day-long sessions, and they occur at about a month apart, the two sessions. So although we had initially thought that we would recruit volunteers entirely from Baltimore, it's been difficult enough to recruit volunteers that, in fact, most of our volunteers to date have come from out of state. And although we don't have funds to support travel to our site, there have been a number of people who have thought that this was such a unique and interesting opportunity that they've chosen to come out to Hopkins for these sessions.
Do you feel that, and let me start over with entheogens or hallucinogens being able to occasion the mystical experience? Obviously, I think some of the research that I've read shows that, between 1 and 100 trips, you can get almost 100% of the people having a full-blown or mystical-type experience. Do you think that doing two sessions is enough for many people to achieve the death and rebirth type experience that would alleviate cancer anxiety?
A great question, and we simply don't know enough about that. So our studies now we ran one study that involved a single high dose of psilocybin, and 60 to 70% of people had a primary mystical experience. We've run a second study in which volunteers had 5 separate sessions in which they received a range of psilocybin doses, and in that case, a somewhat higher percentage of volunteers experienced a full-blown mystical experience. I might say the Good Friday experiment, about 30% did. So apparently our preparation and context is more powerful in terms of reliably occasioning these kinds of experiences. But, you know, there's a lot that we don't yet know, Jan. We don't, you know, whether multiple doses and precisely what doses are going to, you know, increase the probability of these kinds of experiences. And so we'd love to get more experience of that sort to be able to optimize. But right now our protocol is written for simply two sessions. The doses of psilocybin can vary across those sessions. Both sessions involve psilocybin, but at least one of those sessions involves a moderate to high dose. And that's the extent of the design that I can reveal at this point.
Well, it's been a very fascinating interview with you, to say the least. You mentioned your website earlier. Do you have any books or other things that you would like to have people check out? Would you like to give out your phone number or any contact information so people can get a hold of you?
Sure. The website, just again, is www.cancer-insight.org. And I'd be happy to give my email address. That's rgriff, R-G-R-I-F-F, at jhmi.edu. But for the cancer protocol, the information to both email the subject recruiter and the screening phone number is also on the website.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And this concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 13. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Roland Griffiths, and please check out his website. If you know anybody with cancer, please send this interview to them, anyone you know, and spread it far and wide so that people who are going through tough experiences in life can experience such a wonderful thing that Roland Griffiths and Dr. Charles Grobe and one other study that just came my way this week is now doing so in New York, I believe. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. Next week will be either Stephen Booner or Chris Bennett. I haven't decided which yet. One of the two. Tune in to find out. Talk to you then.